This course, which we are beginning today, is one of the more important courses in our curriculum, in my opinion, because every professor thinks every course he teaches is one of the more important in the case. In this case, I'm right. We are the only Bible college I know of, my brother, that teaches systematic theology at the graduate level. Many colleges, when I was going to graduate school, you have to adopt those classes. Many of your colleges have doctoral classes, but this is not the same thing as systematic theology. That's what this course is, the basic theology course focusing on the doctrine of salvation. So, soteriology, of course, means the study of the subject of salvation. Now, you have your text. All your reading assignments are on the page which I gave you. The reserve shelf list. And those are due by the time we finish the different parts. Now, we move at very at uneven speed, so I urge you to start reading. And your coursework will be more valuable to you if you start reading. The text, of course, has been reversed to book by Roger Warren. Now, the other thing that says Cottrell, and of these, some reserve, those are in the file folder, those are in the library. Reserve, I'm going to explain. Or by me, or whatever. Now, reserve shelf list is a couple of those books. Anyway, I put this book by Shank. I used to require reading in Shank. Robert Shank, The Leviathan and the Son, Rebecca and the Son. Those are two very important books. They require reading in them. I don't now because when I adopted this new text, the reading is so extensive. It's much more extensive than this new text that this created an imbalance. But I urge you, in any paper you write, especially certain subjects, that you give attention to Robert Shank. Robert Shank is a former Southern Baptist. He used to teach at Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, now I'm in the Christian Church. One of the finest discussions of basic Calvinism you will find by a former, by a fellow who used to teach it. And very scholarly. And he deals with very, deals with such things as predestination, Calvinism, predestination. And the book, Life of the Son, deals with the doctrines of grace, all of grace, or eternal security. Those are very important books. Now, you'll have a turn paper to the right, and let's look at the requirements of the course very quickly. Let's go over this again. I give you I require a major research paper, 15 to 20 pages, no less than 15. I double space. It must be Turanian. It will be marked down if it's not in the correct form. By now, you should have fairly well mastered basic. Term paper form, but I will permit footnotes at the end of each section. Even the end of the paper if you want to. I did that for two reasons. First of all, takes up a lot of time and energy to see the mechanics of the bottom of the page. This is on a quarter system. Second, I will permit that because many people use computers, word processors, which do not permit input notes. Mine does. And I think it's unrealistic to ask you to change your word processor. So I'm going to admit that every lesson I think to train to give the masterpiece about the tradition. Well, now, if you want to write on any other topic, you must clear with me. You have any of these subjects. And these are very broad subjects. You don't have to cover all of these subjects. I purposely made them broad. You may want to focus in. If you have any questions on what you're writing, clear with me. Don't spend half a quarter and a lot of work writing something I'm not going to accept. So if you have any question, whatever, come and tell me what you're doing. And there's so much you can deal with that This should have a couple in this area. Let me say this to you, this is undergraduate, while this is in many schools, this is a graduate subject, this is undergraduate school. What I want is the same thing I want in Edison College, if you have anything in Edison College. I want basic stuff. Our purpose is to cover the ground. I don't expect, frankly, to learn a whole lot from this term. If it's for graduate school, I would. I don't want you to get creative and intensive and all that stuff, because that's for graduate school. I want you to demonstrate basic mastery for the federal income tax. Do the basic groundwork. This is the question mark. We do that. Any questions? I'm not going to grade you down. But I don't read stuff I've never heard of before. Okay. The grading standards are very simple. Examination for half your grade, the research papers ever have. Which means what? You don't write fair, you don't pass the course. 50 is not a passing grade. Simple as that. So, and my testing in here will be not as extensive as it would be. It will not be as extensive as this in my Western Pacific courses where there's no paramedic. No, it's long tests. It'll be a little more limited. I'll be a lot of time to balance out the work. I do expect a worthwhile effort in term paper. I expect you to be smart to start soon. I say that every quarter. Yes. Okay, let me make it do the. We got a problem. I can't be quite as flexible between the winter and spring quarters. Let me make the paper do last day of the final exam. That's as pretty as I can do. Regardless of where this final exam may be. Last day of final exams at noon. Now, for those of you who have written papers for you before, I have a rule. I don't accept late papers. I'm a bit flexible on that. I will accept late papers. Say, by late, I mean the next day or in the afternoon. But I mark them down, as you know, quite significantly. So if you might write a very good paper, but if it's 3 or 4 days late, it will be marked down for some months, and I think probably what the other half you can. Simply not fair to the other students. Most students get their papers in on time. It's simply not fair to those students. Let somebody get their papers 3 days late and not be severely penalized. So if you're smart, you'll get it done. And I do not accept the excuse, well, somebody is timing it for me and didn't get it done. You are responsible. There are two types that you are responsible. If they're late, that's your problem, not mine. Okay? Now, any questions? Okay, very straightforward class. I have lecture discussion. I've arranged the tables like this for this course because this course, it has built in room for a lot of discussion because we're going to deal with many things which are, frankly, deep. We're going to be finding some ground that many of you have never plowed before, making attention to things you've never thought before. And I expect you to ask me, to stop me and ask me questions you don't understand. Okay? I expect that. I don't want to say, wait a minute, what about this? So I don't agree. Okay, now, we come to the, you can see how the course is divided. Let's look at our contents. You see that? Roman cursive 2, 3. This sort of gives us an overview. Divided into basic parts. Parts 1 through 5, in that order. And look the old creation created. We're going to talk about the nature of the world, the nature of man. The old creation corrupted, the entrance of sin. The old creation condemned, the entrance of death. The new creation begins, which is to study the work of Christ. And the new creation continues, the benefits of the work of Christ apply. I want to point out something for one who is regularly accused of being a Camelite. Look at what subject comes last. Very last thing we talk about. Not bad for splash. That's significant. Often we in the New Testament church, because we have been forced to emphasize baptism, the only six offense of the cows got out. We often get into baptism quickly, and sometimes too quickly. We get people in the baptism sometimes before they really understand what salvation. Now that's not why I did that, but it works out. Now, one more word before we begin, so you know what we're doing here. When I said this is basic theology, this you understand, most of you understand this, I'm sure. There are two ways to study the scriptures. You can do it exegetically, inductively, or you can do it topically and deductively. And there's a place for both. And I'm teaching a course later on today, Daniel. We simply go through the book of Daniel, inductively work, study whatever comes up. If it wasn't the life of Christ, you start through and study whatever comes up as it comes up. And that is fundamental. Now, this kind of work we work the other way. We take various topics and we go through the scriptures and select a piece of the scripture on that topic and make deductions from it to doctrine. Now, in some places called systematics or systematic theology. Okay, now, let's look at, I gave you the Greek word, on the top of the page, do I not? I revised this, this was one of my syllabi to do for revision. Sometimes I'm not sure what I have put on the page and what I have not put that on there. Soter in English. Simply means soto is the Greek form, which means to save, to rescue, salvation, soter. The doctrine of salvation. Now, that's where we are. Part one, the old creation created. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, this puts us to the very basic question, the first question of philosophy, as I point out in the outline, is why does something exist rather than not exist? That is the, we're down to the absolute beginning. In the physical realm, one of the real debates that's going on, and I deal with it, there's an overlap in this first section, and I'm going to give it a light touch. There's an overlap with my course in the history and logic of science. A necessary overlap. But as you may or may not know, there's a real, in the world of physics, world of hard sciences, there's a real debate going on, which sometimes involves creationists like myself, and sometimes it doesn't, over origins. And the question is, did the universe have a beginning? And the latest science suggests that it did. Einstein, theory of relativity, dictates that a beginning for the universe, as opposed to a steady state or continuous creation, as opposed to a universe where matter is eternal, it oscillates, it was a few different things, we'll say the various views in that course, but the old humanistic theory was, was that the universe is always here. You know, the old saying, if you believe eternal God or eternal clock, Isaac Asimov, when he introduces his theory of the cosmos, he says that what he says is that the two ideas of the eternal God and eternal matter are equal, and you have to believe in one or the other. So there's no reason, he says, to go back beyond eternal matter to the eternal God. That is, what he says is that the non-theist has a problem trying to explain where matter comes from, but the theist has a problem trying to explain where God comes from. Therefore, since the ideas are equal, there's no reason to even explore the question of God to the start of matter, which will not hold up. He's wrong on that. Because of the idea of eternal matter, eternal God, eternal thought, and the idea of eternal God are not equal. As a matter of fact, for two reasons. First of all, the presence of the finite, which matter is, logically requires the presence of the infinite. You look at it in a metaphysical way, but if you want to look at it in a more concrete way, second of all, thermodynamics rules out this legal dichotomy, because matter is not simply here. Matter is here acting in a certain way, moving in a certain direction. Understand? And that direction is degenerative. Matter is degenerative. Moving called entropy, you know this, moving from high levels of organization to low levels of organization. Second of all, thermodynamics is a closed system. Matter moves from matter degenerates. So that, you understand, so the matter is not something here. When you said, when you talk about the concept of eternal matter, you cannot leave out the fact that matter is not something here. It's degenerating. It's always been here. It's always been degenerating. It can't be here. It cannot be. That is, well, if matter, the universe, the energy of the universe is being dissipated at a known rate. And if you extrapolate that known rate backwards, you do not get into eternal matter. You extrapolate, if matter has always been here and always been regenerating at the known rate, there's no evidence to the contrary, then matter has already degenerated, we're not here. Well, anyway, so if we look at it, did you all get that? So that's looking at the physical. But in this course, I said that so I can say this, that now we move back one step before that to the philosophical question.
Yes.
What I've been discussing, what Asimov phrases, is the question of what happened, what exists. My point is that according to the although Einstein himself resisted his own conclusions, the theory of relativity requires a beginning for the universe. And such scholars as Jastrow, the god of the astronomers, he's going to make the same statement that the scientists are climbing the last mountain of knowledge, but arrive, pull themselves with the last stone, the last prey, the top, and find them through the theologians. There all along, the universe from the beginning. So, we look at it in a physical way, in that which is in the area of science, we see that the position of that Genesis 1:1 is the best science. That's my conclusion. Okay, arrived at, it's irresistible. Anybody who would deny that Genesis 1:1 is the best science simply does not know what he's talking about. It is defective thinking. The only rational conclusion is that it was him. There was a beginning. And God began it. Okay, science. Accept that? Again, we can deal with that in more detail in another course. In this course, we go one step beyond that. What I just talked about raises the question of what. For this course, we go back to the question of why. Why should something exist rather than not exist? And the answer is not Dr. Cottrell, the seminary, that did one time at the University of Cincinnati, took a course in philosophy. And professor from Smiley's test question. One question is that why? And one student wrote, accept that. This says we do not accept the idea that matter is self-existent. We do not accept, I don't accept, or you don't, because we did, we do not accept the idea of a meaningless universe. There is an answer to the question of why. Why are we here? Okay, that's why I say the first question of philosophy, not the first question of science, the first question of philosophy is why. There is the non-Christian worldview concerning the source of the natural order. The non-Christian worldview says chance, pure chance. And that is, by the way, going out the window now. Too much is known about how things work to talk about chance. Let me just point this out. There is in our library, if you're interested in pursuing this, again, this is an overlap between history and monster science. There is in our library a very important document. I've had it on the reserve, I think. But I've kept it out of circulation because it's, I wouldn't want to lose it. It's called Mathematical Challenges to Neo-Darwinism. You ever seen it? You heard of this? You heard of it? What it is in the 1960s, some of the Murray Eden at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and some other mathematicians and engineers said to Neil Darwin, said to the evolutionists, tell us we can tell you this, but your math doesn't work. Your system is mathematically impossible. What you call improbabilities are, as a matter of fact, impossibilities, mathematically speaking. So they had a big conflict over it, and the leading biologists got together with the mathematicians at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, had this big conflict, and they published it. That's what that document is, Mathematical Challenges to Neo-Darwinism. They published it, and you can read that. But in it, the mathematicians simply said, that what you're saying must have happened, mathematically speaking, could not have happened. You need to start. There was not a creationist there. Well, creationism is not a good issue. It was simply saying, look, your model doesn't work, you're going to have to start over again. What they were saying was that the brand of evolution in all the textbooks is simply impossible. That explanation of it. What the mathematicians were saying. We're not saying evolution didn't happen. Most of them, in fact, believe it did. What they're saying is your explanation of how it happened is impossible. And you're focused on this thing of chance. There are many other things to talk about them by the time in this course. Concerning the source, chance just happens to be here. Concerning the purpose, none. Why not? Concerning the ultimate destiny of the natural order, death. That's the second law of thermodynamics. No one denies that. Robert Frost says, some say the world will end in fire, some deny it. But nobody's saying it isn't the end. We have a sense of endness. We know that we're on our way out. Do we not? Nobody denies that. Our existence here is temporary. The existence of the universe is temporary. At least as under the present arrangement. Now, to explain this world, to understand this non-Christian worldview, let me do it this way. And I don't know if I cover this in Christian logic or science or not. I'm going to diagram the non-Christian worldview. Okay? We have a line across here. And this line, you must imagine this line going on this way infinitely. And this line, this is the past. And this is the future. And it just goes. Now, some say that if it goes, the timeline goes on and curve back on itself.
At the current university, but at the state into what I'm saying here. Got this? This is the eternity past. This is the eternity future. Now, and from what we know, from the second law of thermodynamics, that matter degenerates, that the overriding principle is death. By that I mean the absence of anything, of any organism that's highly organized enough, functioning enough, that functions in a way that can be called living. Death everywhere. One of the most interesting things is that about the space program, it lost a lot of its enthusiasm when they realized they weren't going to find life.
Here you see the modern mind of scientism and its the superstitious character of that mind to show you the overwhelming, ponderous influence of this superstition. You see it in the fact that when the first two teams were sent to the moon, they kept them in quarantine when they got back.
they quit after a while. I can just say $100,000. They just asked me, which they didn't. But I told them only put them in quarantine. Why?
Why would they put them in quarantine? Well, they might have brought back some form of life that would be infectious.
Why would they get the idea they would bring back some form of life? Well, they start with the assumption that life is just happening out there. And since out there has been out there for so long, there's bound to be life out there. And it isn't. I haven't found any evidence of life anywhere. The idea that there's life on other planets is simply a mathematical conclusion based on false premises. The idea is that there's so many out there, there's bound to be life on a few of them. And the answer is why? Well, why would there be, even if you're even theistic, why would God create so many? Why would he put all that trouble? What's a false way of thinking? Is it any more trouble for God to create two worlds than one? Or three than two? No, that's all you have to do is think about it. And so, isn't it the fact there'll be that many? And it's based on the idea of spontaneous generation or abiogenesis, life and non-life. It's ridiculous, scientifically speaking. Anybody said it's not ridiculous, I say to them, okay, you show me the evidence. And what you get is, well, surely, the statement, this statement, surely in all those hundreds of billions of heavenly bodies, there's life on some of them. That is not a scientific statement. Surely is not an argument. The evolutionists have used it so much they think it is. Well, here we are, surely we must have. Well, from the way the word that appears in the books is certainly. Certainly. I went to university one time, I was saying human evolution, chapter department, he signed me a reading, and one page that said concerning talking about the gap between sort of primitive forms and higher life forms. So there's no evidence, whatever. Two pages later, referring back to this and building on it, used the word certainly. So I asked the professor, I said, this page says there's no evidence, the author, and this page is certain. I said, what was the basis? I don't know the basis of his certainty. I said, how would you like this? Mr. Gaskin was going to be kicked out of school because he's been cheating on his exams. And he said, what was the evidence? What about that? Anybody accuse him of it? No. Anybody ever seen him do it? No. Does it fit his character? No. Then why are you doing it? Because I'm certain. What's the basis of my certainty? If you believe in him, you believe in me. You ought to, right? You say, if you're going to be certain of it, you have some evidence. You understand? So surely our certainty say certainly or surely is not evidence. It's superstition. Okay. So, people say, well, surely there's life out there somewhere. You understand? That is not an argument. It's a statement. It's an expression of bad philosophy. Now, you notice, however, there's a little, notice this little thing here? It's in the catch division. This little bump here. If we magnify, here you got eternity past and eternity future, and we're going to magnify this little bump. It looks like this. Got that? And what this is life. Why? Well, because here we are, we're alive, right? In life. And life is an exception. As in the whole universe, listen to me, speaking from a purely scientific point of view, physics, biochemistry, hard sciences, life is an unexplainable accident. Not just an accident, an unexplainable accident. Get it? It's an unexplainable, unexplained. Let me say this way. Life is not simply an accident, and not simply an unexplained accident. It's an unexplainable accident. That is, from everything we know about the way that matter and energy work, from everything we know, life simply cannot happen. Cannot be here. Maybe the second law of thermodynamics. Get that? It's an unexplainable accident. But here we are. Now, life, this little bump, I'm not finished yet, this little bump, life is not simply here, but life is on its way out. This is entered the second law of thermodynamics. Now, how did life get started? Well, we don't know. According to science, this is science on this science, science, life just happens to be here and it won't be here long. In the cosmic view of things. You got that? This is called the oops. I call this the oops concept of life. There should be nothing but death, and there is an eternity of death, and then back to death. This little hiccup is life. And then pretty soon we'll be back to death. Get that? Yes. Now, how did we get to the where did we get this, get up the hill so we can start down? This is the problem. This is where we are. Now, this is philosophy. This is philosophy. Science can only speak of this. It cannot speak of the upward. So, this unexplained accident, here we are. We're on the downhill side of a hiccup. You got that? It's oops. Death, and then just this brief little glimmer. This, by the way, in the eternal view of things, life, even if you grant the evolution is 4.5 million years, the creation of some man for life, the presence of life is less than an eyelash, the blink of an eyelash in a million years. There it is. Okay. Now, therefore, death. The ultimate destiny of the natural order is death. Let me say it this way. If we take the non-Christian worldview, not only does the universe have no meaning or purpose, none, but there is no reason for there being anything but death. Now, I'll list you some expressions of the non- non-Christian worldview. Julian Huxley. He was the Director General of the United Nations. Yes.
Okay. On the first line, really overall, the harm factor is about death. If there's no life, then what is the definition of death?
Death, under the absence of life. Not simply the absence of biological organisms, but the absence of high levels of organization. For instance, we're not talking about a dead dog, we're talking about a dead sun. We're not talking about a dead sun, we're talking about a dead universe. It's equally, when the energy is density, all going to be equally distributed, therefore equally cold, equally dead, equally inert. Where there's no molecular action, there's no reason why it should not be that now, as far as we know, because of this view. Did I answer your question? Julian Huxley wrote, the idea of the universe must have been created. Hence, have a creator is scientifically old hat. The world can now be accounted for in principle in naturalistic terms. To invoke the operation of God in the process is not only unnecessary, but intellectually dubious. What's the key operative word or words in this statement? Where you would focus in and say, well, in principle. I didn't catch you. In principle. The world can now be accounted for in principle. Question, Mr. Huxley, in what principle? And if you ask him, you get back, well, surely. Well, certainly. That simply said was false. It's not saying. Now listen, you gotta watch how they spell it. I'm not doing it, I've done business with it. They're tricky. And they're sincere, they just thought this way. It's like the evolution. These are evolutions. With evolution, you read the textbooks, you get the impression that they'll say, well, now we admit there's problems. We have never said that you know, the whole chain of reasoning is unbroken. And the chain of evidence. But in principle, it's in general, it is sound. In particular, there's the problems here and there. You know, the idea, well, you know, all we need is the link of the promise, and it's established. Now, that is utterly false. I said to my professor at the university, I said about the Professor University one day, I said, you know, evolution explains everything in general, but nothing in particular. He said, that's exactly right. And you go to the geologist and you say, well, you've got some problems. Well, the biology department has the answer. So you go to the biology department and say, yes, the problem, yeah, but the geologist, they've got the answer. And you say, well, it doesn't work here, but in principle, the point is, in this principle, which always embraces all the particulars, the problem is you look at even this particular, and you get, well, that's a problem, and you can't do this one. Look at this one. And I ask the question, how many times can a system, or a theory, fail in particular before it fails in general? And this statement is simply false. It has not been established in principle. It is not a chain with a couple of links in this. It's a couple of partial links. The chain missing. They have answered every question but all of them. So, well, I think, for instance, I got my library, I can show you my library books written, not by creationists. You see, they say, we haven't answered anything. But that way of thinking in principle. Bertrand Russell wrote this. I give you the source. That man is the product of causes which have no prevision of the end they were achieving, pure chance, you see. That his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his love, his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental co-locations of atoms are nearly what? Certain. Nearly certain. On the basis, what is the basis of that certainty? Well, we were here, we must be here by chance. Again, hustling. Nowhere in all the vast extent is there any trace of purpose, or even a prospective significance. Any chance they ever find a purpose. It is impelled, this universe, from behind by blind physical forces, a gigantic and chaotic jazz dance of particles and radiations, in which the only overall tendency we have so far been able to detect is the tendency to run down. So far. Now, the humanistic evolution says this: given enough time in the past, anything must have happened, or anything could have happened. Give us enough time in the future, and we'll find out how. In the meantime, stick with us, brother. We're certain. Given enough time in the past, anything could have happened, and must have happened. Given enough time in the future, we'll find out how. In the meantime, we're certain. Karl Heim describes the view. This is not his own view. He's describing his non-Christian view. The whole creation is like a wood through which the forester has gone with axe in hand, marking with a stroke every tree which is to be felled in the approaching deforestation. So every man, however young and healthy he may be, is already marked for death and has a precisely predetermined time still to live before it is his turn and the universal death which pervades the whole creation. And that's a happy thought. Bertrand Russell wrote that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly plausible and certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hold to stand. And then here's this famous statement, oft-quoted statement. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Now that's an oxymoron. What's an oxymoron? What is an oxymoron? Self-contradiction, no. Welcome to college, no. Of course. It's a self-contradicting statement, like so many other journalists. Self-contradicting statement. The word sophomore is an oxymoron. What does it mean? A wise fool. Self-contradicting statement. So this statement, the firm foundation of unyielding despair, is an oxymoron. It equals. What it is, why is it an oxymoron? Well, unyielding despair cannot, by its very nature, cannot be a firm foundation of anything. I wonder if a lot of controversial kill themselves. You build your life on the firm foundation of unyielding despair. Death is always there. And the ultimate expression of the non-Christian worldview is death. The overall expression. What if somebody asks you, someone give me in one word the non-Christian worldview? You can do it. Death. The question, and death is there. And we know it. But I act like it's not there. Why is America worship? Why is in America youth good and age bad? Some of you guys are sorry for me, but I get so old. Why would these young students do like this for anything in school? Age is not bad. We think it is. Why? Youth is worship, age is bad. Why? Because age is too close to death. That hurts the story one time.
7 feet paid off.
And of course, I know it's all in power property, the clock's being played. And so this person said that they had good ears and just grimaced and suffered through the whole presentation because this one note, this one misquote of the credit. Life is like that. We make our plans and we celebrate our love and enjoy our victories and grieve through our defeats. How to be optimistic and yet, back of it all, there's a note playing. We can't quite ever shut off the thunder which is not. Yeah. Don't get too happy. Why? God says to the ancient Egyptians, we have peace, and thereby celebrating the orgy, and put the end of these on custom, so that you bring around a small coffin, not an actual coffin, the reverend of the corpse, they had rather short about it. They would say, remember, this is something you should do like this, the corpse of the peace. Why? Well, they were enamored with death. They didn't want anybody to get too happy. Because in all your rejoicing, in all your celebrating, remember, this is what you did. Well, you can't shut off that note, can you? As young as you are, as healthy as you are. John Dunn said, send not to know for whom the bell tolls. What bell are you talking about? The funeral bell. You hear the funeral bell? Send not to know for whom the and the note is always there, messing up the concert. And the bell is always tolling. Dead. On that happy note, we'll take our break.
Law of cause and effect then set in as it has. And there is
here's what I want to say, as opposed to, there is operative in our secular society, in our culture is now paganized. There is operative a love of death. Death is not a hated thing. There's a love of death. By that I mean there's a willingness toward death that few would admit, but few can deny. You realize that you and I live in the most killing century in the history of the world. And it is no coincidence that this is the world, the whole Western civilization world, and among us one Western civilization because of the influence of Marx, but the world, in fact, excluding some of the obscure third world countries, the world became a different world with the publication of Origin of Species. Because seemingly or allegedly, the theory of evolution, which of course existed long before that, became intellectually respectable. And death became normal. A debt owed to nature. Death became a useful. You see, differential, for instance, the evolutionists have a phrase called differential mortality. What produced new species? Darwin himself has said, Spencer said, he's Darwin's thought, survival of the fittest. Therefore, the species advances only if the right ones die. If that species can advance. This has been thrown out now. Neo-Darwinism. Both Darwinism and Neo-Darwinism offer the principle that if the species, any species is going to progress and survive, then the weak of that species, the defective, have to die. Death becomes useful. Different. That is, why how can higher biological forms appear? Differential mortality is the phrase they use. Differential mortality, that is, death is not uneven, it's not even. Certain ones die, and then a negative contribution to the gene pool is removed. Do y'all understand? Y'all listen to that? This negative contribution to the genetic pool is removed, therefore the species can evolve and progress. Now, the latest science rejects natural selection. And you know that, don't you? Still the textbook, but the latest thing among evolutionists is that natural selection has nothing whatever to do with evolution. All it does is fine-tunes some forms once they appear, and I have no problem with that. It's like simple adaptation within the context of microevolution. But the world philosophies, communism for instance, and Nazism is built on Darwinism, which still operates, and many of our social policies, that is the world still operates, the humanistic world, the secular world, still operates under the assumption of the usefulness of death, which has created a love of death. Death is not only a debt owed to nature, it's to be desired. If an organism is going to progress, evolutionarily speaking, and survive, prosper, biologically speaking, then the useless must die. One of the things that is not being admitted or said by the pro-abortion crowd is that the impetus in the beginning for Roe versus Wade, the American Civil Liberties Union was scrounging around for somebody to take it to court, did not arise out of a situation that arose out of, say, it arose out of philosophy. You understand? You know, don't you, that Roe was a woman, I think she was in Texas. She was a lesbian who wanted an abortion. And so she sued for the right to lesbian, single lesbian women to do whatever she did. So she sued for the right to do it and won the right to do it. Roe versus Wade, Wade versus prosecution. The impetus behind that, you understand? So she, so the ACLU found her. She would make the court. But the desire to have abortion preceded her. What did it arise from? It arose from some studies that were done in the 50s and early 60s, which, and they were erroneous studies. The data is not good. They have since been discounted. But there were studies which said that. Remember, you saw this back in the early 60s. Much was said about overpopulation, the problem of overpopulation. The impetus to abort came from the fear of overpopulation. We've got too many people. Too many of the wrong people. Now, when it was argued for, it was debated. When the pro-abortion crowd were giving their arguments, this goes back to the 70s, to the 60s. You don't remember this. They always presented the hard case argument. What is the hard case? The rape victim, the life of the mother being endangered, it's the radically defective fetus child, which, is, as you know, makes up less than 3% of all abortions. But they, you know, and they were saying, "Oh, we don't want." They were saying, "Oh, we don't want abortion on demand. We just want." Hard cases, you know, have a right to abort. And those who were opposed to abortion pointed out, you open that door, they're going to have abortion on demand. And they said, oh no! Well, who was right? Now we have de facto abortion on demand. We have, and America has now killed enough of its own population to equal the population of Canada. Now, but my point is, the pro-abortion, the ACLU, the people who were behind it originally, you know, they got Roe to take the thing to court. They were lying all along. What they wanted all along was abortion on demand. Why? You see, the reason they wanted abortion was not that they cared about the rape victim and the defective child being killed for its own good. The life of the mother, by the way, you know, that almost never happens. Most pediatric surgeons who have been in practice for 30 and 40 years, you know that? Most pediatric surgeons who have been in practice for 30 and 40 years have never seen a case where the mother's life had to be, the baby had to be taken to save the mother's life. This almost never happened. They didn't care about that. Those who wanted abortion wanted it because they thought, because of the idea, they still believe too many people, too many of the wrong people. Therefore, death becomes a social tool. Did you know that? Well, they don't admit it. Now, let me show you how this works. Planned Parenthood, which has the right to come into our schools, Planned Parenthood, in America, they say, all we want is freedom of choice. That's what they say in America. That's an absolute lie. Planned Parenthood has officially condoned, sponsored, and helped to finance abortion, forced abortion in China, where they have the one-child rule, and where they take the women and they get abortion whether they want it or not. Now, you understand what happened to freedom of choice? What? But the Planned Parenthood does not want freedom of choice, and Planned Parenthood does not care ultimately, as an organization, I'm talking about every individual here. Planned Parenthood philosophically, ultimately, does not care about the poor black girl who has too many kids and deals with the child and the direct victim. Their concern is we have too many people of the wrong people. Therefore, there is this love of death. Understand? Death is not this dreadful enemy to be feared. It's something to be encouraged. Is that why what Hitler did? He loved death. Why? Death was a useful tool. And he killed six of them. Four and a half million Jews. Killed 7 million non-Jews. Killed more Christians than Jews. Why? Well, because it's a good thing. And of course, the communists in Russia and China make it look like Sunday school superintendents. The number of they killed. You realize that the old men, the Kremlin, when they were young men, starved to death 9 million of their own people. Didn't even have the mercy to put them in gas ovens, just starved to death. Why? Too many of the wrong people. There's this love of death, this enamorment of death. And then you have direct and indirect satanic influences feeding into the equation. And the most logical celebrants of the modern non-Christian worldview are the rock musicians. The most loved, they celebrated death. They have the grateful of what? The grateful of death. And where death is honored and loved and celebrated. Why not? You know what I'm saying? So death becomes a whole new thing in the non-Christian worldview. And because death has been loved, it's used as a useful tool, then the death of the right people, or the wrong people, maybe not the one of you, because they love this, then this is why we live in the most killing century in the history of the world, where it was absolute murder. Any questions on that? Do you recognize this in our culture? Love of death. Well, worship killing them. Now, but my point is, let me repeat it in case you didn't tie it all together in your thinking. What I am saying is that this love of death is a natural effect, the cause being the non-Christian worldview summarized in the word death. Once you accept death as the overriding physical principle, the overriding metaphysical principle, as the overriding philosophy of death, then it becomes the overriding social factor. Of course, the problem is, what if somebody decides that Christians are the wrong people? Decide we're better off without them. Some societies. Well, you know, in China for a long time, pumping girls were wrong. Still in China. One of the problems that China's got is that the ones who are especially suffering now in China are the girls. Because in Chinese culture, see, there is no social, outside of the major cities, there is no social security system. There's vast hordes of Chinese people in their own land. And the way it works is, this is part of their culture, your only security in your old age is your sons. Because daughters go live with the sons, with their husbands, they can provide a little and take care of his parents. You have to understand, if you have a daughter, she marries, she takes care of his parents. But the only security in old age is your own son. And if you only have one child, if you ever want just one child, and your child is a daughter, you do. So little girls are dying in China wholesale. Any questions on this or comments? Because I made my point. I don't have any more time on that.
That's pretty good.
euthanasia is part of it, and the so-called right to die, which really is a right to kill. If you look at the rights, the right to let die, if you look at what's actually going on. Very subtle how it works in. Of course, that, you know, we pointed out, those of us who opposed abortion have pointed out all along that every argument that works against the unborn also works against the born. And it's been used now against them. Okay, well, I say this, let me say this to you. Now, the liberals, if you get a typical universal liberal, I know because I used to live with, he would deny what I said. He would object that phrase, love and death. Because nobody likes to admit that. But you can't deny it logically. And you see, what this love of death has done, the traditional Western civilization, listen to me, Western civilization was built on some basic assumptions. One of the assumptions was the sanctity of life. But since Darwin, we have moved from the sanctity of life to the quality of life as a basis. Therefore, life itself is no longer, has no intrinsic value. It is value only if it has a quality. Those in power, those with their hands on the levers, view as the right quality or sufficient quality for life. Well, liberal would deny that. But they find themselves promoting death, such as in euthanasia, and trying to. Suicide is being made more respectful now. You read some of the arguments. Suicide is a terrible thing we thought it was. Suicide is a very logical thing. They're arguing. There are many who are saying that they're going to live until they are no longer healthy and then they're going to take their own life. That's being honored here. That's being promoted as a rational thing. Well, what goes, of course, is Western civilization, if nothing else. Okay, any questions or comments before we move on? Deb. The Christian worldview, as you know, in contrast, concerning the source of the natural order, not as opposed to chance, an intelligent God who created everything from nothing. That is, the very presence of intelligence proves an intelligent God. Because intelligence does not arise from chance. One accident can never be used to explain another one. As C.S. Lewis points out. Intelligence. Do you understand that argument? That if intelligence exists, there must be an intelligent creator. Because intelligence does not arise from chance. The old argument, as you know, if the humanist is right, his argument is meaningless. Therefore, he can't be right. The humanist is right that there is no such thing as intelligence. There is simply electrochemical processes which are determined, predetermined electrochemical interactions. That's all human. If all human thought is determined, then that includes his thought. And it includes the thought that all human thought is determined. Which means he's in a circle he can't get out of. Only they believe in God now and able to step out of that and say, yes, there exists. You understand? There's genuine intelligence. The humanist, you understand what I'm saying? The humanist is right. There's no such thing really as intelligence. There's only chemistry. Which renders useless his explanation of the whole thing. One accident can never be used to explain another. So we believe that God, there's a source, God, concerns the purpose of the natural order. The non-human order was created for the benefit of man, Genesis 1:29-30. That is, the world was created for man, the plant and animal kingdoms, the non-biological kingdom, the order, the earth, the non-living earth, was created for man. And man was created for intimate fellowship with God. That's the purpose. Okay? Natural order for man. Man for intimate fellowship with God. Concerning the ultimate destiny of the natural order, life. See, the Christian worldview can be summed up in the word life. Life. Life is the original and normal state. Now, that's, see, here's the, remember, what I put on the view, see, the non-Christian worldview says that death is normal. The Christian worldview says that death is abnormal. That life is normal, that death is the exception. Just as in the non-Christian worldview, life is an unexplainable accident. In the Christian worldview, it is death which is the aberration. Death is the exception. That life is normal. It's like this, that in contrast to this view, that life is normal because of sin. I know this is looking ahead a little bit in our course, but we need to do this. Because of sin, death entered. Now this corresponds to this. Death entered, but that through the cross and the resurrection, we are on our way up. The physical world continues down, but someday the physical world is going to join us in life because of the resurrection. This was the physical thing. But the point is that life is the norm.
So here you have a starting point of knowing your creation. But
yeah, that which is eternal is God, not matter. Our energy. So life is normal. Death entered because of sin, but the sin has been taken care of. And so death is on the way out. You see, the non-Christian worldview says life, this unexplainable accident, is here, but it's on the way out. Its days are numbered. The Christian worldview says that life is the norm, death is the exception, and death is on the way out. 1 Corinthians 15, the last enemy that shall be conquered is what? Death. The last enemy. And death has been conquered. And the sentence just hasn't been carried out yet. When Jesus comes back, that will be the end of death. What did we read about in Revelation 21? There was no more death. No more death. Neither crying, the former things are passed away. Life is normal. Now, this is good theology. We must be very careful, we in the church, to never admit that death is normal. Sometimes we do that. We don't mean to. We get hoodwinked. We get stampeded. It doesn't happen when a child dies. Then death is seen as the ugly exception that it really is. Where we get fooled is when an old person who's been sick for a long time and suffering, when they die, and we say, well, in this case, death was a blessing. Have you ever heard that? Death is good. Now, is there anything wrong with saying that? Well, no. Not if we know what we mean. Is death ever good? Only in a very limited way when compared to the alternative. Now, the person's loss is not better. It is not an improvement to go from a sick bed to hell. I don't care how sick you are.
It is an improvement to go from this life to life in Christ.
Yes, but death still, even with that, here's my point. Your point is well taken, and my response to it is this. Even with that, we must never view death as anything but the last or the ultimate enemy. The eschatos,
When it says death is the last enemy, it doesn't mean last in time. It means final. It means ultimate. The ultimate enemy that shall be destroyed is death. And death must never be seen as anything but an enemy. We must be very careful what we say at funerals. Often we throw away our whole doctrine, our whole theology. Many times we as preachers, if we're not careful, we'll throw away our whole worldview at a funeral. Don't mean to do it, we'll do it. Well, God took you. Listen, when you preach a funeral, you must know that God is not the murderer. He is the chief mourner. The picture which symbolizes and represents and establishes this is Jesus at the tomb of Lazarus. Even though he knows he's going to bring Lazarus back from the dead, what does Jesus do? He wept. Why? Because even when life is just around the corner, death is still something to cry about. Death is not a debt owed to nature. Death is not natural. Death is not good. It is bad. It is evil. It is the exception. It is hated. It is the enemy. Not simply the enemy. It is the ultimate enemy. And even in situations where, compared to other things like prolonged physical suffering, even then, it's a lousy thing. It's unnatural. And we know death is unnatural. We could approach this, I could deal with this if I had time, psychologically. For instance, this denial of death, even among Christians. We develop euphemisms for death when they passed away. And the best thing you can say about the body at a funeral is, well, he looks like he's asleep. He doesn't look like he's really dead. And people die in isolation and insulation. We try to deny it. It's very natural. I do. Why? It's unnatural. You understand? We just feel like we are in... You walk into this... I don't care. I've had... I don't know how many funerals. I never kept count. Probably close to 100. At least 60 or 70. I've had a lot of funerals in all kinds of situations. Most of them are Christians. But let me tell you, you never walk into that funeral parlor without feeling that you're in alien territory. I don't care how many times you do it. You're in the enemy's country. Something's wrong here. This is bad. Even if they're saved, they're Christians, but still... This, you get a feeling like this ought not to be. This is unnatural. The funeral industry has worked very hard to make it seem natural for understandable reasons. I'm not condemning them. I'm simply saying, we're not trying to understand this psychology. And the reason this psychology exists, the reason the funeral directors are encouraged to mask death is because we do feel it's unnatural. We sense that. It's in us, like we sense the presence, the existence of God. There's something in us that knows that God is there, and there's something in us that knows that death is unnatural. We were born to live. Life is what we desire. Question?
Yes. What about the passage in Philippians 4:21 where it says, "For to me to live is Christ and to die is gain"?
Again, that's comparative, compared to the situation. That under the circumstances. Under the circumstances.
It's easy to understand, I think, that death is not natural because it came about because of man, and yet it's hard to tie that in with that passage.
Well, what the theology undergirding that passage is that Christ has removed the sting of death. Death, where is your sting? Death, where is your victory? The strength of death, of sin, the strength of death is sin. Why? Why are we afraid to die? Because of sin. And the strength of sin is the law. The law tells us we are sinners. But Jesus has kept the law for us and nailed it to the cross. He has removed the sting of death.
But death is still the natural enemy. The stinger's been pulled. And therefore, you can say, we're going to come back to this in a different angle in this court. The stinger has been pulled. The edge has been taken off. And we're not afraid to die anymore from the eternal viewpoint of things. Got that? From the eternal viewpoint. Death now, an eternal prospect and aspect. In the eternal perspective, death is no longer the great defeat that it was. But physical death is still unnatural. That's what I meant. Even though we, and often we say this, preachers say this, I've said it in my younger student days. Well, you know, when a Christian dies, we ought to celebrate. And you'll never pull it off. It won't work. Why? Even though there is the element of celebration and joy when a Christian dies, and we know that, don't we? There's this relief. There's in back of it all, there's this assurance. But that doesn't change the fact that when that loved one dies, something unnatural and ugly has happened, and we despise it, and we don't know what. You ever notice that when somebody dies, everything you say sounds wrong? Why? It's such an unnatural situation. You say stupid things. I recommend that the ministers, at the least you say, the better off you are sometimes. Just show up and keep your mouth shut in some situations. Not every situation. You understand? So, death, physical death, I'm talking about, is still the enemy. Still not natural. And we must never admit that it is. Because God is life. We are God, the children of God, and we are in the life business, and we affirm life physically. We must be anti-abortion, anti-euthanasia, anti-suicide. And we must be pro-life, because we're Christians, and Jesus is pro-life. God is life, life is natural, death is ugly.
And how do we avoid the trap
when
a non-Christian says, you know, funeral? By saying that, okay, death is unnatural, and it's easy to accept that. From a Christian viewpoint, we understand, we accept Genesis' viewpoint of it, yet we still have to affirm that the death of the body is up there, the ultimate end to it. Don't we have to affirm?
I'm sorry, Scott. You can give it to me again. We have to affirm what?
That the body, we will die. Yeah. The death is inevitable. But how do we, the non-Christian, say that life is unedible, I'm not saying it right, but yet it's unnatural?
Well, the fact is that the fact that death is inevitable doesn't mean it's natural.
But from the non-Christian viewpoint, they're thinking that way.
Sure they are.
Because we're all going to die, it must be natural. And how do we prove that it's not natural?
Well, good theology, the gospel.
I guess I'm still coming to the viewpoint that if they don't accept the Bible, how do you prove it?
Well, that's just part of the general question of the gospel versus error.
Even the Christian, or whether or not a Christian, when it comes time to die, claims for life.
That's exactly right.
Every time.
We know that stuff, yeah. Oh, yeah.
How can we explain Ecclesiastes 7:1, the day of mourning, death is better than the day of mourning?
Well, again, he's talking about the futility of life. It compared to it. Because sin has devastated things. Sin has pitched its tents on the blasted fields of man's lost estate.
Did you write that?
No. ever since sin, directed its tent in the blasted fields of man's lost estate, then it has created a situation in which death has become preferable compared to certain other things. That under the conditions, what Paul means, the hierarchy of Christ is far better. Under these conditions, that is created by sin creates the condition for sometimes death is better than non-death, than living, in the short view of things. But in the long view, overall, death is unnatural. And even in the short view, in this contingency situation, the contingency created by sin, even in that, death is unnatural, and we know it is. That is, when a man says, I'd rather die than live under these conditions, he's not saying that death, therefore, is a beautiful thing. In other words, I help a lot of people die. Let me tell you, it's unnatural. So they don't die when they do on television. I've been with people when they died in the hospital. I work in the emergency room. I've been in the ministry. They call you when they're dying. You haven't been there, you will be. Let me tell you, it's not pretty. They don't die dramatically, cleanly, the way they do on television and movies. It's ugly. In all kinds of ways, some more than others. And it's even those who say, I'd rather die than live, you know, with lung cancer or something, still death is not a beautiful, normal thing. So it's fine. Just be very careful never to surrender to the current love of death. You see, we must not surrender. That's the reason I spent time talking about the current love of death. And we move, an unacceptable step in that direction when we accept the normality of death. And we simply must not surrender even that much. Not even say it's normal. Understand? Because then you're that close to saying, well, it's good. Did you understand my answer to your question? No. Very good question. Under the certain situation, under the conditions. Okay.
Isn't that the very argument of those who want to avoid or kill somebody in the hospital under this circumstance?
Death is better, so we must be very careful about admitting that. You see.
So I'm just having trouble with that in my mind because, according to what Paul wrote, there are circumstances where it would be better.
Yes. Now let's be careful in our thinking here. Look at his situation. He himself remained in the flesh. And to say, and again, we must see there's a short step between saying, well, death is better for me, between that and saying, well, death is better for you. That's why I say we must never surrender the right to die, because the right to die is translated immediately to the right to kill, to make die, and is being translated to that. Because the right to die gives me the right to pull the plug. On who? On you. So, those who are using them, they're interesting. It's like the Calvinists. You ever notice the Calvinists often believe in the predestination to make their saved? Often think that this doctrine is a very holy doctrine, that God predestines certain people to hell and certain people to heaven. They all think they're going to heaven. And by the same token, you ever notice that all those who are for abortion are already here? You know, when I say to Planned Parenthood, they say, if they think there's too many people, and if they think that death is a useful social tool, why don't they kill themselves? Oh, no, they're not interested in killing themselves. They're not out taking themselves out of the picture. They're trying to get rid of me. Or my, you know, somebody else they're interested in getting rid of. In other words, if you ever know, there's always too many of you. You're just the right number of me.
Sure does. Well,
now, and so, even you get my point? Did I answer your question? I'm not sure I did. That even if they are using this argument, they're better off dead. So we must be very. And so what I'm teaching is this, that while there is a Christian doctrine of better off dead, it must be explained. It's in a context, it's under certain conditions. It's a limited, relative thing. And so we must not carelessly use that phrase or that idea, better off dead. so they can easily be misunderstood and translated into the modern love of death. And it is operated that way. Now, so we need to sort this out in our mind very carefully. We have been influenced by this. So my point is, let me repeat myself, even though there are certain conditions in which death is better than something else, yet death is still very ugly. And unnatural. It's something nobody likes. Kind of like a spank. Is it better to spank than not to spank?
Yeah.
Sometimes you gotta spank your kid. But they don't like it, you don't like it. Unnatural, anyway. Well, sin created that condition. You see my analogy there? Better than not doing it. After the other condition. That doesn't mean it's one thing to say, I really love spanking your children, they did. Somebody else say, man, I love beating on kids. And they love getting beaten on. Oh, we have a great time. Just natural. It's a necessary evil. Understand? It's a necessary evil under certain conditions. So death sometimes better than non-death. The better left under certain conditions. Well, I hope I made my point. Think about it. Between now and the next time we meet. But I want you to get this all straightened out of your mind. This is the place to do it. Life versus death.